So welcome to Media Watch. We have a treat today. We have Charles Pierce, who is a political columnist for Esquire. Before that, he was a sports writer for the Boston Herald. He worked at the Boston Phoenix with the late, great alternative newspaper in Boston, and also at Boston Magazine for a number of years. And so for the last six, is that right? He's been writing a column for Esquire. I'm Laurel Leff.
I'm Jasmine, I'm a journalism student.
And so we'll just get started.
So to start off, I wanted to ask, in one of the articles that you wrote last week, you said that during the reign of President Trump, doing this job is being like a fireman in hell. There are no days off and there are no weekends free. So I wanted to ask, how do you think Trump's election has affected your life as a journalist, and what is it like for you to be a fireman in hell?
Well, I have it enormously easy. I know a lot of people who are covering the White House full time, who are there every day, and it's just it's nightmarish. The only thing I can compare it to are the horror stories I used to hear from my sports writing buddies in New York when George Steinbrenner owned the Yankees. You were never off duty. There was never a day where there wasn't news. I know a person who covers the White House, and her first act every morning when the alarm goes off at 5 a.m. is to get on the Twitter and find out what has happened in the previous half hour. I said it was a fireman, like being a fireman in hell. That's not my, it's a line I borrowed from somebody, but that was how covering the Yankees under Steinbrenner was described to me once, and it just stuck with me. There's no normal day anymore for these. I'm lucky. As I said, I'm lucky. I'm a step removed, but. You cannot know whence the next shoe will drop. And I don't think there's ever been a presidency like that, certainly not in my lifetime.
So when do you get on the Twitter? I mean,
I get up at 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning, and by then whatever the tweet has been, the tweet du jour has already had its impact and people are already screaming. So,
and when they start screaming, what do you do? You see the tweet,
you see the tweet, you see the effect of the tweet, you judge whether or not the tweet has any policy impact at all, if it's just venting. If there's a nice way in for you to mock it, you find that.
What's your favorite mock so far?
My favorite mock?
Yeah.
You've done, or you've seen
both.
I've been calling the president El Caudillo del Mar-a-Lago since about midway through the primary season. I kind of like that. I think it's got kind of a Latin flavor to it. I wouldn't begin to respond on Twitter because I don't know. I don't want to respond to the president's tweets. I find that very weird. It's the acceleration of the biggest thing that's happened in journalism in my whatever 40 years of doing it is the acceleration of the process based on the technology. I came on at the tail end of the acceleration of the process that was caused by television. Especially starting out as I did as a sports writer, television changed everything, because you no longer could write a straight game story because people already knew what they saw. So you had to change the way that was covered. You had to make it at the same time more deep and more immediate. But you had to be deep, but you also had to be as immediate as television. And of course, the rise of the internet has thrown everything on afterburners. It's incredibly. It's so accelerated that I wonder whether or not the technology has pushed the news to a speed where we're incapable of ever catching up. And I think that's somewhat concerning.
I noticed you quote a lot from other news organizations in a lot of your articles. How much time do you spend just reading other news organizations, and how do you choose which ones to quote from?
Well, I always read newspapers. I've read newspapers since I was a kid, so I'm used to like backgrounding myself in the day's news. Now, it's a different format now. There are, you know, obvious, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, I don't have to rattle them off. There are niche publications and local newspapers, which I find enormously helpful. I get I get news alerts from the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. I get news alerts from the LA Times. I get news alerts from the Des Moines Register because of Iowa. And it's incredible, out of proportion significance, and how we elect a president. And I find those very, very helpful in terms of seeing what the real world impact of the other stuff is. And over the years I've been doing the blog, I found blogs I can rely on for decent analysis, analytics and otherwise. It's a lot of time is spent writing, and a lot of time is spent synthesizing.
Do you think the public should also be paying more attention to the local newspaper?
Yes, yes, 1,000 times yes. Subscribe to your local newspaper. There are people out there doing just amazing, amazing work. There's a guy who, I can't remember the name of the newspaper now, but he's from West Virginia, and he wrote a story about the opioid crisis in this one little county in West Virginia, right on the Ohio border. And the number of opioid pills that were being funneled into this one county was astonishing. It was like 3.5 million doses a year. And this guy had done all the background to trace where they were going, who was bringing them in, and he wrote the story for the whatever it is. He won a Pulitzer for it. But I never would have found him if I didn't scan local newspapers. The Times-Picayune does a great job covering the ungovernable city of New Orleans. There are local websites now, both partisan and nonpartisan. I think it's never been more important than it is now to patronize your local news gathering operations, whatever they may be.
And how do you fit that into, because you're writing for presumably a national audience. So
I hope so.
Yeah, right. How do you decide, which story fits into the national picture if you're looking at local papers? And I know you do a column every Thursday.
Yeah, but that's about local, that's about the stuff that happens in the States, which I heard about that this morning. There are obvious stories you have to comment on every day. There may be two or three obvious stories that have to be commented on today. Today was, for example, the tax plan and my friend Sam Clovis giving up his job and going back to Iowa where he always belonged after a few stops at the FBI headquarters. You have to comment on those because, as you build an audience, they expect it. Then comes the fun part of the day where you start shopping around and reading federal reports and, like I said, going to local news sites and just finding the little things that maybe people aren't aware of that are nonetheless important to their lives. When I first started, I was filing 7-8 posts a day. And that was because I was trying to build the brand. I hate to say it, God, I hate using this word. But build the brand of the blog and make people aware that the blog was there. Subsequently, at the recommendation of a lot of people who care about my health, I slowed down a little bit. Obviously, it picks up during election season. And I tried to write slightly longer, a little bit more discursively, and tried to make sure every post I do has increased value over just jumping out. There are blogs that do a great job of it. I don't want my blog to be like that. But there are blogs that jump after every shiny object, and there are too many shiny objects. And there are some things I just don't care about. What was the one the other day that I really didn't care? I don't care about Donald Trump Jr.'s tweets. I just don't care. The guy's a peripheral player, and I don't care about his tweets. I have to care about his father's tweets because that's the primary way the President of the United States, God help us, is communicating with his people. So no, I try not to jump every shiny eye, because it's a real temptation. Because there are so many, you know, little things that become big things now that you could write, you know.
So how do you distinguish between shining objects and things that are
instinct,
worth?
Just experience and instinct. And you know, obviously there are some things that have more substance than others.
So have you already written the tax reform? I know
yeah,
you've been spending time with us today.
Yeah, I did the tax reform thing while we were between sessions.
Okay.
Because that's what I blocked out my day to do. I told people in New York that I wouldn't be, you know, it would be kind of a light day because of this. And I did the weekly tour of the states before I came. And I don't know if I'll do something else before I leave or not, but it depends on what's happened while we're sitting here.
You mentioned your health and kind of cutting back on writing the number of articles you write. Do you think that with this, like, inundation of the number of tweets and, like, all these, like, shiny objects, do you think that the mental state of journalists is different than it looked like a year or two ago, just because of how much they have to cover?
Yeah, it's a killer pace now. The first campaign I ever covered was in 1980 for the Boston Phoenix. I covered the Republican presidential primaries, which was Reagan and Bush and John Anderson. And it was still boys on the bus country. You get on the bus, you go to an event, there's a place for you to type your story on a typewriter and send it off on what Hunter Thompson used to call the Mojo Wire, the old, it wasn't a teletype, I don't even remember the name of it now. But the greatest thing about it was at the end of the day, you would go to the bar at the Wayfarer in Manchester or some other place in Des Moines, and you'd sit around with, you know, David Broder and Jules Witkover and Jack German and these guys who have been, and Curtis Wilkie and everybody who've been at it forever, and you would sit there and essentially shoot the shit for 3 hours, and it was a great learning experience if you just kept your mouth shut and listened. One of the great parts of journalism always was hanging around, whether it was hanging around an event or hanging around the newsroom. Nobody hangs around anymore. In 2012, I got on the campaign trail for the first time since 1983. I drove out to do the Iowa caucuses, flew into Des Moines in a snowstorm, drove downtown to the Marriott, went down to the Marriott bar, and all around me were these 25-year-olds going like this. Nobody was talking, nobody was looking up, nobody was watching the football game behind the bar. I don't know how they got their drinks, because I never saw anybody order one. but hanging around is gone now. Sports writers have to tweet every at-bat, even though nothing's going on. I mean, my friend Bob Ryan, that drove him crazy. It's one of the things that drove him out of business. Because I believe the people who run newspapers never quite caught up with what the internet's about, they're overcompensating now, and they're making, I mean, when Donald Trump or Barack Obama or Mitt Romney or somebody gives the same speech in 5 different locations in Iowa in the same day, unless somebody throws an egg at the fourth, at the speaker on the fourth speech, there is absolutely no reason to tweet the same speech 5 times, because it's the same thing. But these people have to do it because they've been handed this incredible maw into it that they have to keep fed. I do think that's intellectually exhausting. It has to be. I have days where I don't feel like blogging, and I don't do anywhere near as much, you know, blogging, tweeting, you know, taking your own videos and everything else that these young people have to do, you know, for major newspapers. It's got to be terribly exhausting. And covering a presidential campaign isn't a great way to get sleep anyway.
Wasn't one of Trump's geniuses, though, is that he understood that, so that while, you know, maybe Hillary Clinton or his other Republican opponents were giving the same speech 5 times in Iowa, he always kind of knew that if he said something incendiary, then he would dominate the news cycle because people would be doing everything.
It wasn't that he was doing anything different. He was saying the same incendiary thing in 5 different places, but it was incendiary.
Okay.
So That's what dominated the news cycle. Not that he was doing anything, you know, like giving. He did have a long time where he would do one or two rallies a day and then fly home, which nobody thought would work, but which actually did. I remember the big one in Mobile, Alabama, which was the first time I this was on Super Tuesday, and this was the first time it began to dawn on me that the guy might win. There are 25,000 people in this football stadium in Mobile, Alabama, which is where he introduced Jeff Sessions, in fact. And it was the middle of the day, it's hot as hell, and these people waited. And he came out and essentially said nothing. In terms of substance. But he pushed all the buttons they expected him to push. He played all the hits. And he got on his plane and flew back to New York. And I walked out with the people, and the people were talking about what he had said, which, as I said, was practically nothing in terms of substance, like they'd heard Moses. And I thought to myself, all right, something's at work here that I'm not understanding. But as the campaign went on, and as I think maybe he didn't, but people around him thought he could win, then he started doing the usual campaign stuff where you make four or five stops and say the same thing, except what he said was inflammatory. So it, as you said, dominated the news cycle.
So you kind of noticed this back in when he was still campaigning, but a lot of journalists kind of missed out on this and didn't realize that he might have won until it was too late. And you said that you think a lot of journalists feel guilty about this, but you think that by feeling guilty about this, journalists are giving bigoted Trump supporters a free pass. So why do you think journalists still hang on to this kind of guilt for not covering the election as adequately as they should have?
Oh, I think you're asking me two different questions. I think some people feel bad that they missed it simply because they missed it. It was a landmark, for good or ill, in American political history, and they didn't get it. So I think a lot of people feel bad simply about, you missed the, you had this giant story right in front of you, and how could you have missed all the signs? I became convinced that he had a better than even chance of winning on the Sunday before the election. I was in Pennsylvania, I drove up to Gettysburg, and, after you got outside of the Philadelphia Metroplex, it started going west and south toward Maryland. You started to see all of these Trump signs, and they weren't yard signs. They were signs people made. There was a couple of those, those rolling marquees you have in front of like clam shacks that say all you can eat 59 cents or whatever, or go Trump. There was a guy whose barn was out in the middle of the field that he had painted red, white, and blue and said go Trump on it. Must have taken days, but it was out there. And that's when I really thought there was a possibility. Now, the other thing I think you're talking about is the constant, let's go to a diner in Ohio and find out if these people still believe in the guy. I think that's been overblown. And I do think that the economic angle, to me, and this is based on a year of watching the guy, economic anxiety may have been part of what drew people to his candidacy, but the xenophobia is what got him to the rallies. It's what got him in the cars. It's what got him in the building. It's what got him yelling. It's what got him hooting and hollering. And I think if you go out and do one of these stories and you cover the former but not the latter, because you feel as though it would be somehow unkind to these folks to intimate that maybe their racial and social hot buttons were pushed, and then they voted accordingly, then you're doing half the job. And I think a lot of those stories, they're still doing them. The Washington Post sent somebody out to Ohio to a diner last week. And at this point, if you're a Trump supporter and you're really disillusioned, and a reporter comes and asks you, you're not going to tell them the truth. You're going to either lie to make yourself look better, or you're going to lie because you hate the press, or you're going to, you know, dig in your heels to, you know, justify what you may or may not have done, well, how you feel about what you may or may not have done. I just don't think, I don't think those pieces have any value beyond making editors feel better about themselves.
Is it a reporting problem, though? I mean, and I haven't done one of those stories. I've read some of them. But is the problem that you're not asking the questions because you're too polite, you know, and it might hurt people's feelings if you suggested that they were xenophobic or racist? Or is the problem they're not going to tell you that they're xenophobic and racist?
Well, I mean, there are ways for them to tell you that without saying it flat out. That being said, I think that one of the problems is that the editor who sends you out of this story doesn't want that story. The editor who sends you out there wants, desperate Rust Belt folks.
Why is that? I mean, why do you think the press clings to that story?
Because to an extent, it's a better story. It goes in more directions than race or xenophobia does.
Because you could talk about the closed plant.
Yeah, absolutely. You can put a historical gloss on it. Number two, I think it makes people feel better, and editors, you know, and
feel better because then we're not a racist, xenophobic society.
Yeah, and newspapers are owned by corporations, which are, you know, large businesses like any other, and they don't want to make waves. And a lot of newspapers are run by people whose worst nightmare is that somebody will yell about them on the radio, or, you know, they'll get marked as lousy on Fox or something, and they don't want to deal with the flying monkeys, and their corporate bosses don't want to either. So, I mean, I don't say that, like, the people going after these stories are dishonest, and I don't think the stories are dishonest either. I just think they're a very narrow view of what happened last November. I mean, I like to read a bunch of stories, if I could, about Hillary Clinton voters who turned out 3 million of them more than the other guy who didn't win. But what we've got is, here's a zillion reasons besides race that Donald Trump won, and here's Hillary Clinton who ran a bad campaign and lost. Those are the two stories we get. Now, there's something in the middle there that isn't being covered, and I would like to know what it is.
Is that something you can get by reporting better?
Sure. Oh, right. Yeah, I think so.
So,
yes.
What if you were the assignment editor at the Washington Post? Mm-hmm. What would you tell your reporter to go out and do?
I would tell him to go out to. I would tell him to go out to a very large county, a suburban county in the Midwest that went for Hillary Clinton, and find out the impact on what happened. Now, you're not going to get closed plants, and you're not going to get rusting factories, and you're not going to get the great visuals. But you are going to get a sense of a different kind of alienation, I think. Mm-hmm. And I think that particular kind of alienation has been undercovered.
And would you also tell them to not kind of feel the need to hold to this idea of having to be bipartisan? There was a Poynter article that offered advice for journalists. It said that, you know, journalists should try to be fair and bipartisan, and you say that fair and bipartisan are not synonymous. It is fair to say that the president lies like he breathes because he does lie like he breathes, but it's not bipartisan to say so. So would you suggest getting rid of this idea of being bipartisan entirely?
Well, bipartisan, and I don't know if you mean bipartisan politically or not, but I think what you're talking about is balanced. Mm-hmm. I think that's pretty much where you're going with this, you know, the both sides
right,
phenomenon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't get rid of it, but I wouldn't make it axiomatic either. I mean, there really aren't two sides to every story. I mean, sometimes there's only one side to a story. Sometimes there's eight sides to a story. And I think, you know, we all should stick to, you know, Paul Krugman's warning that if a lot of the political press today was covering Columbus, one side would say the world is round, the other side would say the earth is flat, and the headline would be "Experts Divided on Shape of World." That's not true, you know? I mean, that's not something, I mean, we are not obligated. You know, if I see a guy walking down the street with a duck on his head, I can write that a guy is walking down the street with a duck on his head. I don't need to get another source telling me that there's a guy walking down the street with a duck on his head, and I certainly don't have to get find a source that tells me there's a duck walking down the street with a guy on his ass. I have eyes, I have ears, I have experience. I can tell you what I see as a trained observer. And I shouldn't have to worry that somebody else might either see something differently or question what I saw. I don't have to go find somebody to tell me I didn't see what I see or saw or didn't hear what I hear. I got in a wrangle in Iowa before the 2014 midterms with Joni Ernst, who's now a senator from Iowa. It was in the middle of the Ebola thing, and she said that President Obama was apathetic toward the Ebola problem. This was right at the tail end of the outbreak. It was literally one person in America had Ebola. He was a guy who was in the hospital in Houston. So afterwards, she came over and did a gaggle, and I was intrigued by the use of the word apathetic because I, you know, it implies that he didn't care. So I asked her. I said, "What? You know, when you said that, I said I never heard that word applied to him before. What did you mean?" And she said, I don't think that he cares about it." And I said, "Well, how do you come to that conclusion from 800 miles away?" And she said, "Well, he doesn't show any leadership on it, and it's still an issue." And I said, "But there's only one person in the country that has it." And she looked at me and she said, "Well, that's just your opinion." And I said, "It's not my opinion. Only one person in America has Ebola. We can find him. He's right there in Houston in the hospital." And she said, "Well, I mean, that's really your opinion." And then she walked away. And I thought, no. I mean, it's not my opinion. It's an empirical fact. One person has the disease, and he's in a hospital getting better. And I just thought, you know, that's where the what you call bipartisan, what I call, you know, the both sides fallacy, that's the logical end of it. Where there are two sides to every issue, and they're both equally valid. I wrote a book in 2000 called Idiot America, where I proposed the three great premises of Idiot America, and the third one was fact is that which enough people believe, and truth is how fervently they believe it. That's how this functions. A fact is a fact. We shouldn't have to walk away from that. And truth is not measured by how many people believe it in a poll, or how, I mean, I don't care how many votes the anti-gravity ticket gets in the election, you're still not going to be able to flap your arms and fly to the moon. I don't care how well, you know, the alchemy party polls, you can't turn lead into gold. You can't do it. And, you know, I mean, this notion that, you know, this was all something that I caught up with when I went to a place called the Creation Museum in Hebron, Kentucky, which is a museum dedicated to the notion that humans and dinosaurs coexisted. Now, humans and dinosaurs didn't coexist. Didn't happen. But this is a whole museum dedicated to the notion that it did. And millions of people, not millions, thousands of people go to it every year. And it literally has a, you know, and so that's what prompted a magazine piece that eventually became the book Idiot America, which was fundamentally a book about the consequences of believing nonsense. And this phenomenon that you're mentioning encourages people to believe in nonsense in a lot of ways. And I don't think that's healthy.
So with an issue like climate change, where, you know, climate change is real, that's
very good
a fact.
Issue on this topic, yeah.
And but the head of the EPA doesn't believe in climate change. And that's also a fact. How do you cover those two sides?
Well, the head of the EPA doesn't believe in the EPA. That's one fundamental problem. This is a guy that was appointed to the head of the EPA while he was suing it, which I don't think has ever happened in American history. He was on, you know, a plaintiff in at least 13 lawsuits against the EPA while he was Attorney General of Oklahoma. Senator Ed Markey found this very amusing at the confirmation hearings. But I dealt with climate change in Idiot America, and the way I did it was I went to a place called Shishmaref, which is a barrier island in Arctic Canada, in the Chukchi Sea. that is gradually being devoured by the ocean for a couple of reasons, both of them relating to climate change. The first is that the ocean doesn't freeze for as long or as hard as it used to. Therefore, the Chukchi Sea is the place where typhoons are going to die. They go up all the way up the East Asia coast, and then they end up, and they what used to happen is they would get to the Chukchi Sea, which would be frozen, and they would beat themselves to death on the ice, and then it would fall apart. Now they don't fall apart. They go up there, and they act like typhoons. This causes incredible erosion on the beaches and on the islands, on places like Shishparam, while at the same time, they're losing the permafrost, which means that the great chunks of this place are being hauled out to sea. There are great pictures on the internet of houses half off a cliff on the beach. And they just, in fact, not long ago, they voted to move. They moved the whole village because it's in 10 years, it's not, that island's going to be gone. And I went up there and I spent a lot of time with them because they're right on the cutting edge of this thing. And frankly, the people at Shishparam think we're out of our minds that we're even arguing about this. I mean, every part of their lives has been impacted by this phenomenon. And they think the people in the lower 49 are crazy to be even arguing about it. I mean, one of them told me they used to keep meat, they're subsistence hunters. So they would go out on the ice, which they can't do as often as they did, to hunt seals and whale and stuff. And they would keep the whale and the meat in what they called the Eskimo freezer, which was basically they'd cut a hole in the permafrost and put it in the ground. They'd wrap it up and put it in the ground. And then cover it up again, it would be fine. You could use it, you know, you could eat it without danger of being poisoned because it would stay cold, it would stay frozen. They can't use the Eskimo freezer anymore because there's no permafrost. And essentially, they're digging into what's essentially peat and muck. So, yeah, I don't, you know, I find it weird that this has become such a hot button political issue because the oceans don't care who wins the political argument. You know, they really don't. If your side wins the political argument, we don't do anything about climate change, fine. But, you know, you're gonna have beachfront property in Tennessee someday. Because that's just the way it's gonna work. I mean, you're gonna ignore the problem, it's gonna happen. But every time I write about it, I think of these people in Shishparam who are dealing with it every day.
But you started off with the Jody Ernst story, yeah. Where the facts don't matter. But you still go out and gather these facts. I mean, it seems as if
that's all you can do. I mean, you can't. And I spoke with a class this morning, and a guy asked me a very good question about what do you do to, you know, break through with, you know, the empirical facts of a story when we are so polarized in our positions as news consumers. And all you can do is present the facts as you gather them. You can't, I mean, if somebody's gonna block them out because he finds them uncomfortable or he thinks your politics are awful or because, you know, his favorite TV or radio star told him to ignore them, there's really nothing you can do as a journalist. You can just present the facts and hope they get through. Otherwise, you know, you're banging your head against the wall. The important thing, I think, is to, I don't want to sound cold, but to not really care about what your audience thinks about what you do.
So why are you doing it?
You're doing it because the job of journalism is to tell the tribe its stories in the hopes that it will do some good. That's why the First Amendment was written. That you have it I'm going to mangle this Madison quote, but without the free exchange of knowledge, popular democracy is a farce and then a tragedy.
That's pretty close.
You want to do good, but I noticed when I was looking through the comments on your articles that a lot of the people who are commenting that your articles are reaching agree with what you're saying. So do you feel like you are moving the ball forward at all? Like, do you feel like you're reaching conservatives and changing their minds?
I hope so, but I have no way of knowing. I think by and large, judging anything on the internet by the comments section is a fool's errand. I mean, because the comments are general, unless, you know, I've had blog posts that got picked up in the conservative media. And then my comment sections got really interesting because you have this influx of folks who wouldn't normally read you was there. But that happens very rarely. Or would get picked up by Meme or Random or whatever that news gathering site is. And so it'd be among a huge list of various political sites, and then I'd get some. But I think judging by, I mean, I love my commenters, so I'm glad they're here. I'm glad that they're. Plus, we run our comments through Facebook, which means you have to be an actual person. I think anonymous comment sections are a sewer, and I don't know why any respectable publication would have them. They're just completely useless. And they almost guarantee that the person the comments are directed to are not going to see them, because you just don't go wading in. You don't get out of a boat in that particular bend in the river. But yeah, I mean, am I worried that I'm cocooned a little bit, you know, ideologically? Sure. But I can only write what I believe, and I can only write what I see. I've watched it since 1980. I've watched the growth of the movement that eventually, and I think inevitably, produced Donald Trump, from the first Reagan campaign to now. And I can only write what I know from my experience. And if that, you know, cocoons me a little bit, then I'm sorry about that. But there are certainly very good conservative sites people can go to. Red State does a pretty good job. The NRO online is okay. Some of the religious stuff on the NRO site is bizarre. But you know, there are sites that I read, just so I know, and I occasionally watch Fox, because you have to. I mean, how am I going to, you know enough about something to mock it if I don't see it, basically. But I do think that there's always a crisis in liberalism because nobody ever gets along with anybody else. But there's also a severe intellectual crisis in American conservatism right now. And unless they take stock of the previous 40 years and understand that those 40 years made Donald Trump not only possible but inevitable, all they're going to do is treat him like a one-off, and 5 years from now, another Donald Trump, except a better Donald Trump, a guy that's really good at what Donald Trump is trying to do, is going to come along, and he's going to hijack the party, and it's going to be even more damage than being done than it is now. Because the one thing that we all have going for us in terms of Donald Trump is he's even really bad at being a dictator. He doesn't have the skill set, doesn't have any idea how to do it. But American conservatism's got, I mean, it's ridden to success by channeling not only, you know, a well-remunerated system of think tanks and magazines and publications and books of various sorts, but also by channeling the anger of the national id, expressed racially or xenophobically or culturally or, you know, in terms of embattled religion or however. And in 2016, that went beyond the party's control. It went beyond the conservative movement's control. The monster got out of the lab. And unless they go back and examine how that happened, they're just going to do it again. And I don't think that will benefit anybody.
Do you think that the media, the, I guess, mainstream media, recognizes this and is reporting on it?
Recognize what I just said?
Yeah, that there's...
Oh, yeah, I mean, I think there are maybe a few too many people who also regard Trump as a one-off, but I think that there's a growing... And some of this is due to the people who persisted, the conservatives who persisted in being never-Trumpers. Some of them have made their peace, which I find ridiculous. But a lot of it is coming from them, that they realize that something has gone badly wrong with their movement and with the party that was that movement's vehicle. And whether or not they will actually try to do something about it is the next step. They're talking bravely. But the people who are talking bravely are also people who aren't running for re-election. And people, and those people are also voting for all the nominees, voting for Scott Pruitt to run the EPA, and they're voting for you know, Ryan Zinke to run the Interior Department, Betsy DeVos to run the Education Department. They're not doing anything to slow Trumpism down, except making angry speeches about it. I mean, John McCain cast the one vote in that important vote against health care. That's one movement. But, you know, God love him, John McCain may not even be here next year. So,
when you look at the White House press corps, and you have been, you know, a critic of this idea of balance or false equivalency, or not telling, saying a duck is a duck, or someone's wearing a duck, well, how do you think the press corps is doing at the moment?
That's a thankless, awful job. It's one job I would never take. I mean, even going back to Tim Krause's great book, The Boys in the Bus, is a whole chapter on the White House press corps, and it's just a deadening awful. I mean, Russell Baker said it was like covering a beehive where you do nothing but sit around and wait for the queen. There's only one. I mean, covering the executive branch from the White House is a giant mistake, because the executive branch is huge, as we're seeing, you know, with the cabinet appointees, who are really, you know, anybody who's getting anything done in terms of this administration is getting it done out in the departments. It's not getting anything, not getting it done out of the White House. I hate that. I mean, you sit there at those briefings, and at the very least, they're the most boring things on earth. No news comes out of it, or very little. The only news comes out of it is when somebody starts a fight. And I think, by and large, these folks have done as well as they can confronting the very unusual circumstances of this particular administration. But it's a job I would never take. Russell Baker said it would kill your soul. And I think it would. You go cover a Congress, you go sit up in Congress, there are 500 people and they all love to talk. And they all have staffers who love to talk. You know, the White House, you got one guy. And
he loves to talk, though.
I mean, well, not to you. I mean, you can cover that from your room. I mean, you cover that from your apartment, because it's on television. I think the White House press corps, as defined by the people you see on the briefings every day, do as good a job as they can at a really awful job.
And the press more generally. I mean, are you thinking in terms of how the press is doing with the unusual circumstances?
Well, I think that certainly that we all benefit from the fact that there's an apparent newspaper war between the New York Times and the Washington Post. I think individual reporters have been given license to do terrific work. David Fahrenthold at the Washington Post, and several people at the New York Times whose names escape me right now, covering the different aspects of what makes this administration unusual, most notably the relationship with Russia and, you know, the various business dealings that are kind of weird, and the qualifications or lack thereof of the people who are getting appointed to different things. I think it's been by and large very good journalism. I think there are about 50 Pulitzers laying around the White House lawn right now waiting to be picked up. And I think people are doing a good job doing that. But most of those are being done by people who aren't at the White House every day.
What about the sense, and I think that the press, I mean, for some of the reasons you were talking about, having to do with the reluctance to cover xenophobia or racism, wants to impose sanity and rationality in a situation that may not be sane and may not be rational. I mean, that's kind of what you do as a journalist, right? Is you explain things. And where do you think the press is in terms of that? Are they capturing the essence of the administration? Is that not the job of the regular press corps? That's a job of people like you, and so as long as you're doing it, it's okay if they say, I mean, now they're somewhat pulling back, but I mean, I think the example is the generals are going to bring sanity to the White House. So, you know, whether it's Kelly or Mattis, and with Kelly, they're pulling back from it a little bit, but it's hard to abandon that. It's don't worry, folks, we're going to be okay because.
Wow. I think there's a tendency for anybody in the media, because they are essentially citizens, to hope somebody's at the wheel. I mean, because otherwise we're all in trouble. But I do think that I don't think it's strictly the responsibility of people like me. I think it's the responsibility of everybody. But again, if people choose to believe or not to believe the facts you present them, there's really nowhere to go. There was a story in Politico today about the president's upcoming trip to Asia, 12 days in Asia, and it explained that none of the briefings last more than 5 minutes because his attention wanders. And there was another anonymous White House official saying, you know, God, we wait every day in the hopes that he doesn't say something that's a disaster. Well, beyond that, what can you do? Beyond reporting that, what can you do? If people are going to look at that and say, that's the way we want, you know, that's just him. That's the way he does things. Well, okay, but you know, don't be surprised if, you know, suddenly we're you know, embracing the crazy guy in the Philippines, or you know, we're scaring the hell out of the South Koreans. But I mean, once you've gotten to that, once you're down to that level, once you've admitted to yourself that, you know, your profession can be defeated by irrationality, there isn't really any place to go. I mean, you just got to keep doing what you're doing.
I think they're kind of objective with their facts. They just lay them out there, and it's the responsibility of the public to kind of connect the dots. But in your columns, you kind of like spell things out very explicitly. You give your opinions on it. Do you think that this Trump era, if people aren't connecting the dots on their own, is it a call for a new kind of reporting where there are more opinions and you are kind of saying things more explicitly for the public?
I don't know. I think a lot of what's going on in terms of where I am now, a lot of that started during the George W. Bush administration, when the political blogs really took off. I think we're better served with a kind of mixture of these two different approaches. As long as the mainstream press is doing its job well, giving people like me a chance to spin off their work and connect dots that maybe they didn't have space for or whatever, then I think you've got something very, 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 very good. If you can maintain that synergy, that's a good thing.
And you think that's where we are now?
I think that's what we're getting. I don't know that we're there now. I think there's still a lot of, you know, there's a lot of snobbery towards blogs. I mean, there still is. Even though there are people writing for, I mean, nobody writes better about the intersection of politics and power than Josh Marshall does. I think that we're getting there. I think we're getting, you know, we're understanding the two elements of what could be a very beneficial synergy, but I don't think we're there quite yet.
When you say we're getting there, do you think that when we had Ethan Bronner in last week, we kind of tried to ask him these questions about media coverage and how we're doing about that, and he kind of said that he only really has enough time to focus on himself and his own reporting and what his team is doing. Do you think that the media is doing enough self-reflecting to get us to that point where we can be doing better?
Yeah, I understand what Ethan's saying. The one thing about that question that is never going to be answered, I don't think, is that the media is never going to get together and do something. I mean, we're not going to have a big meeting someday, you know, on the field in Kansas and decide we're going to do X, Y, and Z. It's all thousands of individual decisions. You know, regardless of what people may think, we do not think with one mind. We do not act with one hand. So I don't know whether or not we can have a single period of self-reflection. I think as long as, you know, I always say, people ask me about journalism ethics, and I say, you know, I don't believe in them because I believe if you're ethical, you're ethical. If you're a dishonest auto dealer, you're going to turn back odometers. If you're a dishonest banker, you're going to embezzle. And if you're a dishonest journalist, you're going to make stuff up or steal it. I think ethics are ethics, but we certainly don't have enough time, given the accelerated pace of the information and how we get it now, to reflect. The pace, especially in like a presidential campaign, there's no time to reflect. And I think it would be well for people who are in positions of power and talking to people and in charge of people covering elections to give them the occasional weekend off so they can sit there and think about the long view of what they're seeing instead of being this camera's eye every day. But no, I think that it's going to depend an awful lot on each individual journalist.
So we kind of missed, journalists kind of missed, you know, Trump, that big story. Do you think that, where do you think journalists' current blind spots are? So what do you think we would, like, look back on in a few years and realize that we've been doing incorrectly?
Well, I think there were a couple of really bad examples of that prior to Trump. That was the relative quiescence of the media in the run-up to the war in Iraq, because there were people reporting, McClatchy guys and the Knight Ritter guys in Washington, the BBC, reporting the fact that a lot of what we were being told from the administration was wrong or incorrect or not substantive or, frankly, a lie. The other one is, I think, the failure of the economics press to see the collapse of the economy in 2008 coming, the failure to cover how absolutely dangerous the derivatives and the CDOs and everything were to the overall economy. Those were two enormous blind spots. One of them, I think, the first one, I think, resulted from a kind of obsequiousness to power, which I don't think you're seeing anymore. I'm certainly not seeing it now with this administration. And the other one was very simply because the financial press was a kept press in a lot of ways. They didn't want to hear from the renegades who were out there waving their arms saying, look, this whole thing is a castle. This is a castle built on sand. I mean, now, it's funny. It's funny because often you can only know these things in retrospect. I watched, if you watch Ken Burns' Vietnam thing, documentary, the clues were all there that this was a fiasco. The French were telling us it was a fiasco. There were people in the administration, and there certainly were media people at that time, although in the early 1960s, the contrarian media opinion was that the war wasn't being fought well, not that it should not be fought at all. But right now, I mean, it's hard to find an area right now, I think, that the media is completely ignoring or blind to. There are things that I think are underemphasized, and one of the biggest ones, I think, is environmental justice and the thousands of little tiny time bomb, chemical and environmental time bombs that are all over the country that, in the era of deregulation, are going to cause incredible damage. I mean, lagoons of pig excrement in North Carolina, and old chemical plants in West Virginia, one of which just blew up last week. Nobody knows what's in it because the documents all went up in the fire. I went to a place called Kingston in Tennessee where a lagoon of a reservoir, really, of coal ash slurry, the levee gate broke and it went down in this valley and subsumed entire neighborhoods. The guy said, I looked out my window and my trees were going by. This was all just this incredible slop. I mean, it's like, coal and byproducts and stuff. And I think there are lots of those. I think criminal justice reform has fallen off the radar again.
you know, for a while it was going to be the one issue that brought Republicans and Democrats and liberals and conservatives and libertarians all together. Now we're back to lock them up. Now we're back to, you know, throw away the key. We've got prisons all over America that are bursting with too many people, and they're going to explode. And then when one explodes, and a lot of people get killed, people are going to say, how did we get here? Well, one of the reasons you don't know how we got here is because we didn't cover the damn story.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that you say that, because both of those examples, environmental justice and criminal justice reform, I think both are very directly tied to race. And like you said, race is a big part of, and xenophobia is a lot, it's a big part of why we missed the Trump election as well. So what, I mean, I know you talked about this a little bit earlier, but why is it so difficult for us to cover race?
Well, because it's a terribly difficult subject, especially for those of us who are of the white persuasion. You persuaded us, anyway. it's a hard thing to cover. And I think people my age who came of age, he said, whacking the microphone, came of age during the Civil Rights Movement, saw what we perceived as white people as a triumph, but we also saw it as a complete triumph, and it wasn't. Just as Reconstruction wasn't, there was a backsliding in the 1980s, and we're still coming back from that. And I think, you know, the real gift of writers like Ta-Nehisi Coates and Jamelle Bouie and Jane Costin and those guys are that they're young black people who came of age after that. They came of age during the backslide, came of age during the sudden lack of interest in the conditions in the cities, came of age during in rural areas in the era when environmental justice fell off the radar, who have cousins or brothers or fathers in the overcrowded prisons. But these people are now speaking out and trying to force a new conversation on race is, I think, a tremendous thing. I'm glad I was around to see it. I'm glad I'm around to meet these folks. But one of the reasons why race isn't factored into a lot of these stories is people are desperately uncomfortable talking about it. I mean, it's not an accident that chemical plants and oil refineries, et cetera, are put in poorer neighborhoods with minority populations. I mean, nobody's going to put a lagoon of coal slurry in Wellesley, or name an affluent neighborhood. It's not going to happen. But I think that the stories of the people living with that, and the stories of the anger and futility of people living in areas like that. I know Cory Booker just did a tour of a bunch of places in the South, and God knows he's got enough in New Jersey, too. I think the stories of the anger and futility and sadness of the people who are watching their children sicken is certainly worth as much as the guys in the diner in Ohio. But again, if you confront the racial aspects of that, it's very, very uncomfortable for the people who are reading you, it's very uncomfortable for the people who are editing you, and it's very uncomfortable for the country at large, and it ought not to be, but it is. And if you're asking me why that isn't a component of these stories, that to me is why.
Speaking of uncomfortable, another uncomfortable story that has gotten a lot of attention lately has been the story about sexual harassment. And of course, it started with Harvey Weinstein, and now it's spreading. It's even, I guess, in the UK, people in Parliament are also. But the thing I'm having trouble with is we have a president where there have been 16 women who have at least accused him of similar behavior, maybe not quite at the Harvey Weinstein level, but it just feels very odd to have, you know, all these people falling, right? You know, including journalists. I mean, we just saw the head of NPR and Mark Halperin, and yet the president. I mean, if this is our standard, right? You know, if you just need a certain number of women to come forward and said, who are credible that you sexually harassed them, and that's enough to make you resign. What do we do with the fact that the top person himself was not in that position?
Imagine how the women themselves are feeling about that question. And just off topic for a minute, politics is the next stage of this rocket.
Right.
We all know that.
Right.
Von Abraham wrote a column
right.
about sexual harassment at the State House. There's a long piece in the Oregonian from the end of last week about sexual harassment in the Oregon legislature.
In California.
And the United States Capitol. All of these places are, you know, shot through with these stories, especially if you're going to go back, you know, 20 or 30 years. I mean, you're going to get literally thousands of these out of various political operations. That having been said, the question about the president is a good one. The question about the president is an excellent one. The question about the president is, I don't think, ever going to be answered, because I don't think you're going to be able to get a Congress to move on a president. On that issue.
But we're not even seeing the reporting on it, right?
Well, I mean, the issue that, you know, what about Trump is in every story that I've seen.
I know, but what I haven't seen is reporting, right? What I've seen is, you know, women, and in the period after Access Hollywood, women came forward and journalists wrote stories about, here's this woman came forward, and this woman came forward, with this woman came forward. But there wasn't the New York Times pulling it all together, establishing. And, you know, maybe it's because there is no pattern. I mean, I don't even want to presume that you could do that and could come up with as coherent a story as the Times was obviously able to do with Harvey Weinstein. Although, with all these other people, it hasn't required a coherent story. But I mean, should we go back and do a coherent story about Donald Trump, or you can't? Because
I think there were stories during the campaign. Certainly after the Access Hollywood tape. I mean, there were 17 women whose names we know, who have accused him. I mean, once you've done that,
and it doesn't.
What's the second day story? 17 more. I mean, that seems to me to be the only place for the story to go. Why it has not, you know, it's not had the same impact as Weinstein or any of these other people, it's because he's president. I mean, I don't think there's any other reason you can name. It's a very good question, for which there is no answer, except it shouldn't be that way. He should be, you know, penalized at least as much as Harvey Weinstein has been for doing the same thing. But that's the only logical answer, and it's an answer nobody wants. I mean, it's an answer that is somehow unavailable to us. I don't know why. Well, I mean, I do know why, but...
To switch gears a little bit, I wanted to ask just more generally
about... I was shifting gears.
about your role as a columnist. So... And Dan
a communist?
Columnist, sorry. He's a commentator. In 2011, Dan Kennedy wrote on his blog, "Anyone who follows Charles Pierce on Facebook knows the guy was born to be a political blogger." Did you always know you would end up as a political
blogger? No, I had no idea. I was a magazine writer, and I was perfectly happy working in long form, and I still love it. I just got this, I think Dan was writing... I think Dan was writing after I'd gotten the blog.
Yeah, he was.
You know, I appreciated what he said. I don't think anybody in my generation, you know, grew up thinking I'm going to be a blogger someday. Nobody knew what it was. You know, I grew up wanting to work for newspapers. I grew up wanting to be, you know, wanting to cover stories and to write stories. I didn't have any idea that this was going to come my way. But as I said, I was shaped by the ethos of the alternative press, which required you to have a voice, which required you to inject opinions, which did not require you to obey the rules that other reporters were trained to obey. And I've been lucky enough in my life and in my career to have a series of editors thereafter who allowed that kind of thing to flourish with me. But no, I mean, I don't think I didn't, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up, Charlie? I want to be a political blogger. No. Well, first of all, I don't know that it requires that you grow up to be a political blogger.
And in making that switch, you begin to become paid to give your opinion all the time. Do you feel like during that transition you began to view your own, the value of your own opinion differently?
I don't know. I valued my opinion pretty highly most of my life. No, I mean, I always had a lot of opinion in my writing. I wrote a column for the Boston Herald for 5 years. I essentially wrote in my magazine work, was fairly rich with opinions. I've been lucky. I haven't had to spend a lot of time operating under the rules that a lot of other people have had. And the good rules, I mean, they're, by and large, they're helpful. But they just were never part of my world.
Do you ever, and this will be the last question before we open it up, feel like you went too far in terms of your opinions or your characterizations? Or
yeah. Now you're going to ask me for an example, and I've got to come up with one.
Yes.
Well, according
I think what? Go ahead.
I was just going to say, according to Commonwealth Magazine, you were disciplined by the Globe. And
oh, but that's not. I don't think I went too far.
You
don't think no, that's a whole different thing. And unfortunately, I'm legally prohibited from talking about it. But
we should say, at least for the what you said, that we can say, right?
Sure.
If you don't talk about it, just so that.
Oh, yeah, you called a Senate candidate Christine O'Donnell a crackpot and a sideshow freak.
Yes.
But that wasn't too far.
No. I think I also called Newt Gingrich a doughy fraud. that was another thing for which I was disappointed. But in any event, no, those I don't think I went too far. I don't know. I think I was one of the very first profiles I did for Esquire when we all moved over there in 1997 was about John McCain. And I came to like him a great deal, as people will. I think I may have been too harsh on him in 2008 when he ran for president, because I think he wanted to be president too much. And I think, I don't know if I was acting out of my own personal disappointment or not. But, I mean, I do think he did a lot of things in 2008 that he wouldn't have dreamed of doing in 2000.
Sarah Palin?
Sarah Palin, that's a big one, but mostly, in 2000 he gave a great speech after the South Carolina primary when he was slandered almost beyond belief by the Bush people, where he talked about what he called the agents of intolerance, and he included in that speech leaders of the religious right. And I thought, it's written by a friend of mine named Mark Salter, who's his ghostwriter. The speech is written by, and I sent Salter an email saying that that's one of the greatest speeches I've ever heard an American politician give. It was like, in 2008, it was like he never gave that speech. He was sucking up to the same people. And I found that, I think I found it so personally disappointing that it affected the way I wrote about him. And reading some of the stuff I wrote in 2008, I would go back and maybe temper it a little bit, because I think I was acting out of a personal sense of disappointment.
Good. Okay, let's open it up to other questions. And what we'll do is we'll turn the mic around.
Oh, yeah.
So that we can hear what the questions are. Okay. Is that good? Is that going to be
good? Who's ever first?
All good?
Yeah.
I had two things, actually. One was, you mentioned how you kind of hoped that right-leaning people would listen to you, but you didn't have much hope that they would, because people are kind of stuck in their own ideological bubble. But then you kind of look on your Twitter account, and you're, like, quote-tweeting Donald Trump Jr., saying, like, your father doesn't love you, and just kind of, with all due respect, kind of nonsensical things like that. Why would someone on the right kind of take you seriously when you're kind of putting things out like that?
I don't think they have to take me seriously, but they have to take some people seriously. They have to look at what their movement has become. I mean, if it's not me, this is something where I become an old guy. I don't necessarily believe that tweets are news. I mean, they are, in the sense that it's the President of the United States, and this is his chosen, means of communicating with the people. So you have to cover it. I don't think somebody else's Twitter account is
the sum total of what they are. Do I make wisecracks on Twitter? Yes, I do. Do I think Donald J. Trump Jr. is a joke? Yes, I do. Do I think that, you know, his criticisms are cliched and banal, and do I think he's going to wind up in front of a federal court someday? Yes. Do I think that should prevent someone, a serious conservative, from looking at the conservative movement and wondering where it went off the rails? I hope not, because if they don't listen to me, they should listen to somebody, because it really did. And, I mean, I noticed the sticker on your, neither one of those guys would be recognizable in today's Republican Party. Reagan, maybe, in his early days when he was giving the speeches for Goldwater and George Bush, maybe. Daddy Bush would not have a place in the Republican Party today. There's no place for him to stand. There's no such thing as a moderate Republican anymore. Jeff Flake is not a moderate Republican. Jeff Blake was a Reagan conservative, a hard bar, Freedom Caucus, Reagan conservative. And now he's a moderate Republican. That's a huge movement to the right from Daddy Bush. Or even really from Governor George W. Bush. The power behind the forces that helped elect Donald Trump, and certainly the power behind the forces that nominated Donald Trump, has grown so great that people like that don't have any place to stand in the wind now. And I mean, there's no place to stand in the hurricane anymore. And somebody, I mean, if they're not going to listen to me, they can listen to somebody who maybe doesn't snipe on Twitter the way I do. But they have to listen to somebody, because it's not good for the country. That's just the way I feel.
The other question, like, what do you think would be the difference between, like, yourself and, like, Sean Hannity, except you come up from it from the left and he comes on from the right, in terms of
I like to think number one, that I write better than Sean Hannity does. I like to think that I think better than Sean Hannity does, and I like to think I'm a little bit more bound to the truth than Sean Hannity is. But your mileage may vary. That's what you ask me. What the difference I think there would be? That's the difference I think. Oh, come on.
It takes sometimes.
You, on to the topic of Twitter, I know that social media has become a place that journalists have to be more careful about what they post and who they repost and how they repost it. Do you think it's something that journalists should be careful of? Do you think it's dangerous to have?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think they should be careful because their bosses are watching, basically. And I think, you know, college students should be careful because their future bosses are watching. And as we all say, the internet is forever. Do I think that there's been overreaction to, you know, some tweeting and retweeting by reporters? Yeah, I do. I mean, I think the internet in a lot of executive suites, in all of its forms, still scares people to death. But I think if you're in the business, especially if you're starting out in the business, that's a factor. I mean, that's what you have to consider. You do not want to put bullets in the gun for them. Do I think it's a danger? Yes. Do I think it ought not to be a danger? Yes. Do I think it's a danger? Yes.
Do you think it's necessary for journalists to have that social media presence, though?
It seems to be. I mean, certainly it's being demanded of them. I mean, you know, I mean, the people, like I think I pointed out, you know, the people covering for large newspapers, whether it's news or sports, seem to be required to tweet. I mean, I know the sports people are. They're tweeting every at-bat, for God's sakes, in some cases every swing. They're being required to have a social media presence. At the same time, they're being required to maintain, they're being required to submit to the control of somebody else on their social media presence. And I don't think those two dynamics are compatible for very long. I mean, I think the one thing about social media is that it's a little bit more of the Wild Kingdom than bosses would like it to be.
Right.
So, yes, I think your question is necessary, and my answer is yes. Not only is it necessary, but people are required to do it.
Yeah. Hi.
Hi.
So,
you mentioned blind spots earlier regarding the 2008 recession and the Iraq War. Do you think it's like human tendency that we always need to be, there always needs to be a catastrophe before we realize we've made a mistake? Or
yeah, I think it's an unfortunate human tendency, but I think, yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, media attention has been drawn to catastrophes ever since the first photographer showed up at the first tornado. You know, disasters are great news. But I do think that we could do a better job developing sources independent of the official ones. This is what the McClatchy guys did in the run-up to the Iraq War. They did a brilliant job of reporting the people who were disagreeing with the conventional wisdom. And those people happened to be right. But the McClatchy guys had to go out and find them. And then they had to work them as sources. I think the 2008 thing is a little bit different because I think the financial press, a lot of members of the financial press were as delusional about what was going on as the people, you know, who were essentially almost destroying the world economy. I think that's an example of the perils of access. They were, and this happens in political writing all the time too, but they weren't going to write that these people on whom they depended were essentially didn't know what they were doing and were well on their way to wrecking the economy, even though there were people in that world. I think of, you know, Brooksley Bourne, and for that matter, Elizabeth Warren, and Nora Rubini, and a whole bunch of other people who were waving their hands and jumping up and down and saying, look, this stuff is, I mean, it's toxic, it's worthless. I think that requires, to paraphrase something, a willing suspension of belief. You know, because it's easy to believe that these people know what they're doing. It's harder to believe that they don't. It's scary to believe that they don't. Or it's scary to believe that they might have their own personal agendas or you know, preferences that to which they will make the facts conform. But yes, I do think it's a tendency among the humans in journalism to watch the catastrophe and then wonder how it happened, instead of reporting on the run-up to it and maybe avoiding it.
Sort of following up on Nadja's question, I mean, one of the things that I think has been very striking in the last year is how Trump's base stays with him. Even in the face of some more policy considerations that seem, you know, the economic agenda that he seemed to be using along with the xenophobic agenda to bring people into his fold hasn't played out by his appointments or his policies. Do you see, I mean, is there a catastrophe that would change that, or is that the 33 or 35 or 40% just
I think if he
there?
I think if he launched on North Korea, that would, you know, do something with that particular portion of his base. I think if he fired Robert Mueller, you would see an incredible firestorm. There's another part of me that wonders whether or not you're right, that 33% is just an unmovable number, that this is a commitment they've made to something, and they're not going to be shaken by it. And, I don't know what the solution is or what the answer to that is, but
you do think firing Robert, because I think we've gone different senses from
yeah, but I think that at this point, I mean, it might only drop down to 25, it might only drop down to 28, but it would drop, and I think that's all it would take for some other Republicans to say, man, we can't deal with this. But you know, like I said, it's not going to drop down to 5. It's going to drop, but maybe only 3 or 4 points.
Hey, how do you deal with, or not you, how do you think the press has been dealing with the lies of the administration?
I think they've been pretty good about it. You know, certainly Daniel Dale from the Toronto paper keeps a running tally every day. Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, the use of the word lie, which I thought I'd never see in a mainstream newspaper, has become fairly regular. I think there are different kinds of, you know, things. Like, for example, when George H.W. Bush said, "Read my lips, no new taxes," in his acceptance speech, and then raise taxes, I don't think that was a lie. I think that was him responding to economic circumstances that arose on his watch. I think it was framed as a lie, and I think it did him terrible damage, particularly by Pat Buchanan in the 1992 campaign. But I don't think it was a lie. I don't think he got up there and said that knowing he was going to have to raise taxes. I think he lied when he said he didn't know anything about Iran-Contra. I think that's a whole different thing entirely. I would not make into a lie something a politician said that just turned out to be wrong. Just, you know, this guy was wrong. This guy, he knows he's wrong and says it anyway. And then he repeats it. And and people say, "Hey, you're wrong." And he repeats it. And he understands that you can inundate the press or the media, and therefore the American people, with so much easily refutable nonsense that people become numb to it. People become, you know, accustomed to it, acclimated to it, normalized is the word I guess people are using now. And that's a problem we've never faced before. Nixon told lies. Nixon told lies that were a little bit harder to disprove. I mean, this guy looks at the guy with the duck on his head and says, "He's looking at a duck, he's looking at a duck with a guy on his ass," every day. Easily refutable, incredibly obvious untruths. And then moves right along to the next one after he gets called out. I don't know where journalism goes with that. I really don't.
You know, one thing I wanted to ask, since you've spent time reporting on sports, I kind of wanted to ask you how you feel about the whole relationship between, like, Trump and the NFL and the protests, just in terms of that being, like, this intersection of sports and politics, and to what extent you feel like sports should become political, and to what extent you feel like politicians have a right to kind of get involved and voice their opinion.
Well, I mean, I grew up in the 1960s when the last time we had a large scale, you know, a large amount of activism among athletes, from Muhammad Ali to the Olympic Project for Civil Rights, to, you know, the Kurt Flood case, the rise of the players' unions, and so forth. Sports has always been political. Sport, I mean, I always said that if you did sports writing right, you could cover everything in the country through that prism. Race, the impact of technology, television, the internet even, class, civic corruption. So when you have a period like we're going through now, where for some reason we have a generation of athletes who are very political and very politically aware, and also know how to use social media to network in their politics, then you've got something very special. And I don't think, you know, this didn't start with Colin Kaepernick. It started with Trayvon Martin. I mean, if I remember correctly, it started with people wearing hoodies, the Miami Heat and the Cleveland Cavaliers. I think that politically aware athletes are good things. I think that, you know, if they're involving themselves in issues like these athletes are involving themselves in, I think that's a good thing. I think sports and politics are inextricably connected. And I think any attempt to separate them is silly, because you're talking about large-scale public corporations with tremendous impacts socially, culturally, and economically on the areas in which they're located. And all of that is political.
You talked earlier a lot about how all a journalist can do is report the facts and hope that it reaches people. What dangers do you think data journalism and the rise of that sort of movement poses in terms of?
I don't know. And I'm perfectly willing to admit that. I got into journalism because they said there would be no math. seriously. And I am woefully behind on things like that. I think that data journalism is, I'm going to borrow a line from the late Molly Ivins, is a tool. I mean, you can use it to build a house or you can hit yourself in the hand with a hammer. I mean, it's a tool. It can be used for good or for ill. I think that the only danger I can see is that unscrupulous people would use it to confuse and essentially camouflage what they're really up to. I think that certainly it's here to stay. I think, you know, people coming up in the field right now have got to be literate, at least fundamentally literate, in how to read the data and how to interpret the data. And God help us, that means they may have to take statistics classes. But as I said, it's this is something, again, when you talk about the cross-pollination between politics and sports, this came into being because of the analytics movement in a lot of ways, and the analytics movement in sports, and the place that the analytics movement in sports found for itself to promulgate was on the internet, largely. The hidebound sports editors in America didn't want anything to do with it, and still don't. I think it's certainly now required that everybody who covers politics become at least basically literate in how to read a poll, how to tell a good poll question from a bad poll question, a good poll from a bad poll, good data from bad data, conclusions that proceed from data and conclusions that are not substantiated by the data.
Okay.
One and then two.
So my question is about something slightly different. You mentioned the snobbery that exists towards blogs. And I just wondered if you'd ever experienced that or felt that yourself, or what would you kind of say to combat against that?
A little bit, but not much, because I had already, made something of a reputation myself in the business. So, people who remembered my magazine stuff, cut me some slack, I think. But I do think there was, and still is in many quarters, a substantial bias against taking blogs seriously. And I don't quite understand it, but I sort of understand it because it's a whole old guard, new guard thing, but at this point, I don't know, it's like ignoring Twitter.
You said earlier that given the opportunity, you wouldn't take a job as a White House correspondent. Who do you think should do that kind of job, or should they?
Well, I think somebody has to. I would give it to the youngest. I would make sure it was a young person, first of all, because it's no job for anybody with a family. It's no job for anybody who doesn't have the energy to deal with the ennui. I know that sounds contradictory, but it's true. I think it's a good beginner's. But I would, were I an editor, I would assign people to cover the executive branch, without necessarily putting without necessarily concentrating on the White House.
Like what?
Well, cover the departments. The executive branch includes all cabinet departments, all sub-cabinet departments. That's a lot of people. That's a lot of policy being made. And right now, since the president doesn't appear to be, a hands-on kind of guy, and that's not the kindest thing you can say, the policy in his administration is being made by the cabinet members. It's not being made by him.
So that's where the action is.
That's where the action is. And there are more people to talk to. There are field offices, there are staff in Washington. The day-to-day coverage of the president, which is essentially being, a Secret Service agent with a pad and a piece of paper, let one of your rookies handle it and let him get experience in the hurly-burly, and you'll get a better reporter out of it. If it doesn't work out, then put somebody else there. But I would not take it. Just like, this is one of my pet peeves in newspapers. They take their best reporters and they make them editors. And 9 times out of 10, what they get They lose a great reporter and they gain a mediocre editor because the two skill sets are not the same. I can't edit. Everything I edit sounds like me. And you know how writers feel about that. It's like promoting your plumber to be your gardener. I mean, being an editor, and they don't do a good job training editors either, and they should. There are people with the skill set to be editors. I've worked, thank God, with a lot of them who can't write their names. But they can make your stuff great. And I think that especially newspapers have fallen or fell into that. This is my own personal hobby horse that I'm inflicting on you. But newspapers fell into that because it seemed like a logical progression because editors made more money. But you can't, I mean, you know, you'd be a managing editor, I guess, you know, where you're actually, basically you're dealing with people, you're not dealing with copy. But to promote somebody who's a really good writer to be an editor.
Two different fields.
Absolutely two different fields, yeah.
Hi.
Hi. I like her, she says hello every time.
You said earlier that all journalists can do is present the facts, and in terms of the environmental change that we're going through, I think we're doing a fantabulous job of, did I say fantabulous? Fantabulous job of covering climate change stories. Every day there's a story of a certain community going through some kind of distress because of all of this, but yet we have a president that says, nah, I'm gonna pull out of the Paris Climate Accord. I mean, how can you convince such people?
I mean, that was one of the things I tried to explore in the book, and I don't know. I mean, I don't know if Harvey and Rita and Maria weren't enough. I don't know. I mean, it's like gun control. Newtown, Connecticut wasn't enough, if Las Vegas isn't enough, if three hurricanes in a month and a half wasn't enough. I don't know. I mean, you record the facts as you know them. You give the people a look, you give your audience a look at what is happening. You interpret the facts as best you can, and as simply and as clearly as you can, and you hope for the best. I mean, that's really all there is.
Do you think it's time we change the dialogue of saying, oh, the planet is dying, to, hey, the human race is the one that's
dying? I think if you don't believe the planet is dying, you're not going to believe the human race is dying, because that's even scarier. This is a mystery. I mean, I get most of my really good reporting on the climate crisis from overseas, from online, from European newspapers and you know, Asian newspapers and stuff. And what's amazing to me in the United States is that there is one department of the United States government that's taking climate change very seriously, and it's the military. The Navy Department is moving heaven and earth trying to climate-proof places like Newport News and the New London Subbase and stuff, because they know, they believe the science, the Dutch believe the science. That's why they're way ahead of us on doing things like building levees against storm, or building, you know, mechanical devices that will help you. I don't know what to say. That one mystifies me, because it's not that hard. There's a legitimate consensus. I know there's a propaganda apparatus financed by the extraction industries that's very strong, but as I said earlier, the ocean doesn't care if you win the argument. Miami's got seawater coming up through the sewers every time it rains. They know. I mean, the people in Miami know. The people in Shishmaref know. The people in the southwestern Pacific, whose islands are gone, who've had to move to New Zealand where they feel out of place because that's solid ground, they know. I mean, there are people all over the world who know. It's just this one just fries my shirt.
Emblematic, though, right? I mean, and it speaks to the idea of is there any possibility for common ground? Is there any possibility? I mean, can you make a persuasive argument? Or do you, I mean, partly what you seem to be saying, and I understand why you say it, but it's just, I just keep doing what I'm doing, I put the facts out there, but at some level, if it's not making a difference?
Are you asking me if journalism is in some cases futile?
Yes.
Yes, it is. And it has been proven to be so in the past.
But you're saying in some cases, therefore yeah. You think there are still ways in which it...
Oh, sure. But I think what you have now in terms of politics is you've got an insulated political class who doesn't care. You've got, people in hopelessly gerrymandered districts with lots of money, and they don't really have to care. It takes a lot to dislodge a member of Congress, and certainly there are places where your political survivability depends on not recognizing the fact that the climate is changing and that we're all subject to the consequences thereof. That's where I'm at.
Okay, well, I think we're done. That was great. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you for having me.